Welcome to this very special Christmas episode of Democratically 2020, the podcast all about the politics, policies, and personalities of the 2020 US election and beyond. I'm your host, Karen Robinson. So I want to welcome Emma Burnell, friend of the pod and virtual co-host, practically live in our basement here at the pod. To this very special Christmas episode of Democratically 2020. Hello, Emma.
Hiya, how are you?
I'm, COVID-adjusted normal.
Exactly.
But I suppose I should start by saying happy war on Christmas.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? That was always supposed to be the left doing that.
seems like the war on Christmas is really raging this year. In a very literal way.
And it could be worse. We could be lorry drivers.
Yes. For those who don't know, in Britain right now, we are in a country where not only can we not leave our houses, but also lorries can't get in and out of France because we're all locked in by this new strain of the virus. So, yeah. Happy holidays! After so much time spent, Boris Johnson saying that, Keir Starmer was ridiculous for, even suggesting that people might have to stay in their homes for Christmas. 3 days later, it was like, oh, sorry, that's what we're doing now.
And of course, what that led to was everyone spending a lot of money on travel plans and more food than they can eat in their bubbles.
Yeah.
And it's just cruel.
Yeah.
He must have known that this was an eventuality. Yeah. So they should have played it a lot more cautiously.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's the disappointment of the hopes, but it's just a fitting cap to this year of trials and dramas. And, we keep saying roll on 2021, but we've got no guarantee that 2021 is going to be any better. But
I think the first few months will be, worse because it will be cold. And we're still trapped in our houses. I'm hoping that, spring to summer, we actually start to see some improvement. But I'm not getting my hopes up at the moment because they just keep getting dashed.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound very seasonal or very festive, but I do think keeping your expectations low and then being pleasantly surprised by whatever festive joys you can find is probably the way to do it. Hey-ho, it is what it is. I think... at least we've got a new president to look forward to next year. So we've got that.
That is something.
So the theme of today's show is a holiday theme, because I thought it might be quite useful to have a think about this wonderful Christmas tradition, which my daughter would describe as being the main point of Christmas, which is gift giving.
Hey,
the traditional American excess of piles and piles of great big boxes underneath the tree to a degree that's insanely ridiculous. And every year, my husband and I always say to each other, we must be more restrained this year. We've got to just be reasonable. Let's set a limit. And every year we look at the tree and go, yeah, no, we've done it again.
My favourite story about my nephew when he was very, very little, he had his stocking and he had lots of presents in his stocking and he opened them all up. And then he came down into the living room and saw that there were presents under the tree and he said, more presents!
An embarrassment of riches. Oh, my joy. Huzzah, huzzah. So, yes, yeah, so I wish that feeling to the protagonists of this podcast, to all of the politicians that we've been following, lo, these many years. I hope that they will... Most of the politicians that we've been following lo, these many years. But in this season of charity and goodwill towards men, I'm even going to consider some presents for the president current. So we thought we'd spend this show thinking about what political gifts we might give to the people that we've been talking about in this show all these years. And so first of all, should we just have a quick conversation about what do we think makes a good political gift? What does that mean to you?
I always give my dad has his birthday just after Labour Party conference.
Yeah.
So I always try to get him, and he's a complete Labour Party obsessive, so I always get him a book or something that I've got at the conference and maybe try to get it signed or whatever. I once, at the National Policy Forum, it was Father's Day, and I got all of the sort of senior politicians from the Shadow Cabinet to wish my dad a happy Father's Day.
Oh, that's delightful.
So that was quite a good political gift, I think.
That's a great political gift.
But I think a gift for a politician is slightly different. I mean, you could have one that's real. So, you know, you could give Boris Johnson, you know, a wooden spoon. but you could also have a rhetorical one. You could give Boris Johnson the gift of humility.
I don't think he would accept that. He might return it. Try to exchange it for some more hubris.
Sadly so.
I think that's fair. So let's start with the president-elect. Joe Biden, who is a man who has had, obviously in his life, suffered a lot of traumas, but also has been given a lot of gifts. You know, it's been a life of peaks and troughs for Joe Biden. What would you wish for him? What would you package up and put under the tree if you could grab it, whether it be an idea, you know, a political advantage of some kind, a piece of knowledge you would share? What do you think Joe should have as he faces his first year as president?
I would gift him 2 senators in Georgia.
Ding, ding, ding. That's going to be your winner, isn't it? Tell you what, why don't we split that? You give him one, I'll give him the other one.
Fair play.
We can write a joint card, like, to Joe with love from Karen and Emma. Yeah, 2 senators from Georgia is going to be the gift you won't return, isn't it?
Right, but we hope they are returned, as it were. the difference in what he could do in his first 2 years between having a Democratic Senate and a Republican Senate, it's, you know, it's immeasurable.
Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between a consequential presidency and a presidency with a real legacy.
Yeah.
No matter what Joe Biden does, his presidency will be consequential because he's in a position just by the virtue of taking over from Trump, who's in the process of systematically dismantling the federal government as we know it. The consequences of his presidency will be huge. But with 2 senators, he could actually start solving some of our problems as opposed to just not making them worse. And that would be amazing.
Yeah.
100%. I think the only other thing, maybe we'll call it a stocking gift. if I could tuck a little gift in Joe Biden's stocking as well as the sort of big under the tree gift that we've just given him of 2 senators in Georgia, I wish for him that it were possible for him to have some kind of inaugural celebration that would be befitting of the moment. But we all know it's probably not. It's not a good idea for millions of people to gather on the Mall right now and celebrate. So, you know, I hope that they will be able to find some other way for him to mark the moment. I'm sure they're going to do a fantastic virtual event of some kind. But, you know, I hope he finds some joy and celebration in the moment, even though it's happening at such a difficult time.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Shall we move on to the second most important person in the Democratic Party right now, Kamala Harris? What would you wish for our first African-American, our first female, and our first Asian-American vice president?
So Kamala loves to cook. So I'd probably get her something like a really nice package of cool new ingredients that she could try because she's going to be very, very busy. So I want her to get a little bit of downtime while she's gone the Christmas break. And I know that one of the ways she relaxes is to cook.
Nice, nice thought. I like that. Yeah, she is, as you say, an enthusiastic cook. Maybe you could send her like a package of British ingredients that she might not have tried before.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's a joke in America that British food is horrible. And also there's every like 6 months or so, the New York Times does a, you can't find any decent cuisine in London article. So bizarre. It's like, have you been to London since the 70s?
Yeah, the food is actually quite good here. At least it is now. Who knows what happens after Brexit, but.
But let's send her Marmite.
Do you know, I bet she could whip up some brilliant concoctions with Marmite.
I mean, all Americans should just get into Marmite because it's just the best thing ever.
I absolutely loathe Marmite, but I accept that people with better palates than me do like it. So,
I mean, it is, Marmite is actually used as a euphemism for, it's a very divisive thing.
You either love it or you hate it.
No one has sort of a middling opinion on Marmite.
You better explain to Americans what Marmite is, because it sounds bizarre when people explain it. You're like, people really eat that? But no, they do.
Marmite is called yeast extract. It's basically what's left over at the bottom of the barrel when you make Guinness. It's a very salty, very treacly, dark brown spread that you mix with margarine or butter and put on your toast or your sandwich. And while I'm not selling it particularly, it is gorgeous. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
Marmite.
Well, enjoy. I wish you joy of all the Marmite. I'm sure Kamala Harris.
I travel to New York, I always take a jar with me. Yeah. If I ever do manage to move over there, my mum's going to have to send me regular care packages.
I would be fascinated to know, Kamala Harris, what she makes of British Indian cuisine. Because, of course, she was raised by her Indian mother. She cooks Indian food. She's fond of a curry. But the British take on Indian food is almost, it's a different cuisine in its own right. Not because the British adapted it, but because the Indian community of Britain adapted their cuisine for English palates. But also just because they, you know, it, almost like, you know, they were Australia, right? They were like an island that, you know, came up with their own version of their cuisine. So they evolved. So I'd be curious to know, you know, what Kamala makes of, you know, the British adaptations of English Indian cuisine. Yeah, nice food gift for Kamala. I took a more kind of conceptual approach to the gift here, and I said that I am assuming Kamala will be running for president in 2024, assuming that Joe Biden will not run. I wish her a lot of primary opponents, because I think she has the best chance of, A, for her sake, I think she has the best chance of winning the primary if there is a fair number of other people running. As we saw this year, I think, you know, if there's a lot of people sort of competing for attention, it's very difficult for things to, for new candidates to break through and really have their moment. And that's, unfortunately, that's what happened to her in this election. I think as sitting vice president, she comes into it with a much more commanding position. But I also just think it's like, it's good to have that kind of, the kind of robust conversation and showing off all the different parts of the party. So I think it's probably helpful both to her and to the country that we have another robust primary in 2024, even if I would be perfectly happy if she comes out as the victor of that competition.
Yeah, no, I think it, and I remember you saying that one of the reasons, and I think Jon Favreau said this as well, one of the reasons Barack Obama kind of crashed and burned a bit on his first debate in his second election was because he just hadn't been used to it, because he hadn't gone through a primary process at that point for 4 years. So, yeah, I think it does toughen people up and gets them ready for whatever's coming next.
Absolutely. That is my take on it. So let's move on. Next set of political gifts. Let's go to our girl, Elizabeth Warren. She is... has not been gifted with a cabinet position. I don't know how she feels about that, one way or the other. But what would you like to put in Elizabeth Warren's stocking or under her tree this year?
Well, I'm guessing she hasn't got a cabinet position because they're worried about Massachusetts, they don't want to have another Senate election.
Because the last time we had a Senate election in Massachusetts under difficult circumstances, it didn't go particularly well for us.
Yeah. So maybe what I gift her is a Democrat who could definitely win Massachusetts. So she can go off and be something really cool in the government. What I really want to give her is a hug, because I love her. So, those are the two things I would give Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, both helpful. I would love to give her a hug as well. I'd love to give anyone a hug at this point.
Yeah, right.
Literally anyone. But Elizabeth Warren would probably be in my top list of people I haven't actually met that I would like to give a hug to. Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I thought, actually, you know, knowing Elizabeth Warren as I do, and knowing what she cares about, and knowing what's happened during the Trump administration, I'm going to give her a gift that I hope she will actually get anyway, which is a restored Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Obviously, setting up the CFPB was a real, you know, it was a linchpin in her career. It was a point of great pride to both conceptualize that agency and then establish it as an agency that had real teeth and real ability to protect consumers who were defrauded by their financial institutions. Trump has been systematically dismantling that, but it just takes good management and good administration to put it right back on track. And I, you know, I know that that is something she will care about a lot. I hope that Joe Biden prioritizes it. If he does not, I'm sure she will be piping up from the Senate, be like, Joe, just about that.
Yeah.
But I hope for her that that happens, and that there is a, you know, strong leadership at that agency. It has been deliberately sabotaged by the Trump administration, but, you know, it can come back.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it's just, if you want something that absolutely demonstrates the priorities of the Republican Party, it's taking away consumer rights to not be defrauded by the bank.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I mean, it's so cartoonish.
I mean, it is ridiculous. I mean, and that's the thing. Like, the things that the CFPB were prosecuting were already illegal. It was just about making sure that there was an enforcement action taken when consumers were defrauded. So it isn't even about passing new legislation. Anyway, yeah, don't even get me started. But yes, bless her. I know that Elizabeth would care about that almost more than anything else. And it goes to show that I think she probably, more than her own personal political ambition, what motivates her is the ability to deliver good policy. And so I think that that's fitting. Right. Working our way through the Democratic primary. What about Senator Bernie Sanders?
Oh, what would I give Bernie? A really strong successor, actually.
Yeah.
I want to see Bernie's wing of the party succeed. You know, I'm on the left. But it cannot all be carried by old guys.
Yeah.
No, okay, there is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but she's very young. But you need a deeper bench. And I think they could really do with, you know, three or four Alexandra Ocasio-Cortezes. and so, yeah, I think what I'd like to give Bernie is a, you know, a torch to pass on and people to pass it to.
Yeah. So when you say successor, you mean kind of within congressional power structures, not specifically in Vermont. Because, you know, presumably he'll resign. It's like he'll retire at some point.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. But no, what I mean is for the progressive wing of the party to have a deeper bench so that he can basically chill out a bit.
Just chill, Bernie. We got this. Like, let's pass the torch. Take the baton. Off you go. Yeah. I was thinking along similar lines. You know, what could we do from Bernie's point of view to help him feel like he's left behind a legacy? And I was thinking along similar lines of like, how can I give him something that would help make sure that he has an impact on the party as he wants to? And so I started thinking maybe a successor, but then I thought, actually, what he really needs is to establish within the Democratic Party a better base for his positions, because, of course, he's an independent socialist, and that I don't think was a very smart political strategy in terms of getting his ideas embedded. So I don't know how he'd feel about this, but my thinking was a good legacy for him would be to establish a Democratic Socialists caucus within the Democratic Party. So if you got, it only takes probably three or four, you know, people to start identifying as a Democratic Socialists caucus within the party, and suddenly you can really shift things. You know, they can become a voting bloc that becomes really important. And I think, you know, not to be presumptuous, but I think if Bernie had started kind of focusing from that point of view sometime before, he might have been able to impact earlier on things like Medicare for All, etc. So yeah, so I would push for, you know, I would gift him a caucus.
That's a very good, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot is that Bernie, one of Bernie's weaknesses was that he wasn't a member of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
That he wanted to lead.
Yeah.
So which, you know, some people are going to find objectionable, even if they agree with him on the whole.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a very sensible gift.
What about our new Transport Secretary, Pete Buttigieg?
What to give Pete? That's a tough one. A train set?
Literally. A very big train set.
I know less about Pete's personal life, if you know. I mean, I know he's got a lovely husband, but I don't know his tastes the way I know. Sort of, you know, he didn't do that kind of personal bit other than the lovely husband. So I would gift him joined up government, because actually what transport needs is an understanding that if you want to get from A to B, you have to work together.
And transport infrastructure is something that it kind of links to the gift that I wanted to give, because transport infrastructure is notoriously something that everyone can agree with it in principle, but it's still incredibly difficult to get it delivered because, as you say, so many different stakeholders, state and local, you know, different branches of government, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to do things like planning permissions, et cetera. I think your gift and my gift will go nicely together. Like, they're in lovely matched set. Again, we can share a card, because I wanted to give him a big infrastructure spending stimulus. So I think, but you need the one for the other, right? Like,
absolutely.
for him to be able to, you know, play with his big train set, you know, it will be helpful for him to, you know, make sure that the governments are working, the different government levels are working together better. But within that confines, if he had the kind of stimulus spending on transport infrastructure that would be useful. And specifically, I think, from a political point of view, if he could have some transport spending that is focused on urban communities, because I know he cares a lot about urban regeneration, I think it would help him to be able to demonstrate politically that he can work with urban communities, because I know he had big problems with the Black community in his primary. But if he could really deliver for that community projects that will, you know, they are demonstrably improving lives across the country in urban communities, I think both he would make that would make him very happy. It would suit his skills, and also it would be politically beneficial to him.
Yeah, no, that sounds good.
All right, we have arrived at the moment of truth. In the spirit of Christmas, love and forgiveness, peace on earth, goodwill towards men, in genuine hand on heart, you know, wishing him no ill to the extent that it is possible to do so, if I asked you to give a president, the current president, a gift, what would you give him?
A happy and long retirement.
Ah, there you go. New set of golf clubs. Yeah, the time and space to go and do your thing.
That's a positive gift, but also a gift to the rest of us.
Yeah, like may he live well and happily and far from here. I was thinking about it and I thought to myself, in all seriousness, I would probably give him like the Calm app or some, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy. I don't know that he would accept those gifts or use them as intended, but I genuinely think that apart from all the other things, like, his psychological problems are deep and longstanding, and he probably suffers from narcissistic personality disorder, as we've talked about in this podcast before, for which there is no treatment. But I do think that just purely on a behavioral level, as a human being, he would benefit a lot from getting more sleep. He would benefit a lot from avoiding like his impulsive behaviors, like his compulsive behaviors to tweet, his compulsive behaviors to never be able to switch off the news, his compulsive behaviors to like wake up. I mean, he's clearly waking up in the middle of the night and live tweeting. And that's not a healthy lifestyle for anyone. So I genuinely, hand on heart, wish for him that he would get some psychological kind of just like operational balance, right? Like, you can still be twisted and wrong and authoritarian, but like, get a good night's sleep and maybe you'll just be like better at being a person.
That would be good. I mean, it would benefit us all if he was better at being a person.
Yeah, it would be a good thing. Okay, so we've done a long list of political people. I'm not going to go into like Mike Pence, Nancy Pelosi, all that kind of stuff. But you know, shout out if you've got any ideas in those realms. But let's
like get Mitch McConnell a long and happy retirement too.
Yes, yes, Mitch McConnell. I wish you like a retirement to a horse farm in Kentucky or whatever you want. That's fine. Go and enjoy. Let's take a step back. If you, Emma, as a British person, were able to grant a gift to the people of the United States from British politics. Sorry?
Besides Marmite.
Besides Marmite. Do not send us Marmite.
Don't know what you're missing, guys.
No, thank you. What would you give?
A gift from British politics to American. The parliamentary system, honestly. I think it doesn't always work, and we've had a tough few years, but actually I think it's a lot better than the gridlock you've got your system at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the concept of presidential politics was designed with certain assumptions about how politics operates by the founders that are just clearly not true, right? Like they clearly thought the big problem in politics would be between the branches of government, and that's not the case. Once you've got a national two-party system, breaking things down, yeah, I'm not for it. I was wishing for the American people as a gift from the British system, similar to kind of what you were saying, I would wish them a durable but more adaptable constitution. Because I think Britain's constitution has a lot of flaws, and it's, you know, I've always thought it's very strange that it's not a written constitution. But what does work very well about the system is that you have, you know, a very long-standing constitutional framework in the UK, but it can adapt to the needs of the day in a relatively fluid way. You know, not in a kind of transformative overnight, like, if we decide this doesn't count, this doesn't count. But, you know, I think for the American system, it would be better if we could improve our constitution as we go along. And I think the Brits have done a pretty good job about being pragmatic about how to make that happen. What about the other way around? What could the Americans offer as a gift to the Brits?
I think the pardon power, despite it being massively abused at the moment, would be something that I think would be good. That sort of space for clemency we don't have at the moment. And I think that would be something that would be beneficial if it were not abused by a bad politician.
That's so interesting, because the pardon power itself only exists in the American Constitution because it was effectively a gift from the European system of, you know, the monarchical authority. They were sort of trying to replicate one of the powers of kings that they actually thought was kind of neat.
Yes, but obviously our queen doesn't do that kind of thing.
No, Elizabeth would never. I was thinking, and this is going to be really controversial, and I know that people will vehemently disagree with me, so the tweet is at KarenJR. You can shout at me. But I kind of think, and I'm sorry to my Liberal Democrat friends, I would, under the current circumstances, I would gift Britain a two-party system as opposed to the three-party system they have now. The reason being that Britain, like America, has a first-past-the-post electoral system. And in my view, it is not helpful to a country with a first-past-the-post system to have the kind of more liberal/progressive wing of its politics divided into two camps. It makes it very, very hard for a progressive to ever gain a majority. Now Emma's going to tweet at me.
I am going to tweet at you.
At Karen Jarrett.
It wasn't the Labour Party that the Liberal Democrats went into coalition with. Not every Liberal Democrat is on the left.
Sure. But if you broke the Liberal Democrats, so the question is, if you broke the Liberal Democrats and the Conservative, if you broke the Liberal Democrats down, what proportion of them would wind up with in Labour, which proportion of them would wind up in the Tories? I'm just not convinced that the way that power is structured currently, where the Liberal Democrats are, or can be, I mean, you know, frankly, they don't matter that as much as they used to anymore. Anyway, I mean, you've got things like, but then you've got things like UKIP messing things up, etc. I just feel like in Britain, the opportunity for people to come along with minority parties and act as spoilers to the entire national leadership is not helpful to you. I mean, it's not helpful to you that UKIP can do that. It's not helpful to you that the Liberal Democrats can do that. It's probably better if people are forced to negotiate within a coalition, come to an assessment within a coalition, whether it be the Conservative coalition or the Liberal or the Labour coalition, come to the accommodations between themselves about what they want, and then go forward as a national platform, able to gather the majority of the public. The prospect of minority rule, which is, I would argue, kind of what you've had for a very long time now here, is not helpful. Our system's not great either, but at least it's kind of a 50-50 divide in the country that is based on genuine divisions that people have. Whereas here, I don't think it's well represented. That's my case.
I just don't like the Lib Dems. I mean, I've got that tribal Labour thing where I just don't like them, Karen.
But that's the thing. It's like, okay, you don't like them, so do you want them to? But like, if they're the difference between Labour taking power and Labour not taking power, wouldn't you rather have them in than out?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is, what I would be concerned about as someone on the left of Labour, despite not being a Corbynite, is the dilution of Labour's offer that might come with an influx of more centrists.
Mm-hmm. That is a reasonable concern. It is also a great recipe for never governing.
I know.
I mean, you do have to make that choice at some point. Like, I do feel like, sorry.
I literally did a tweet stream on this last night.
I mean, it's all very well and good to say, oh, we should be really pragmatic and practical and do what we have to do to govern, until you're faced with having to do something you don't want to do. And then it's like, no, but I don't want to make nice with Liberal Democrats. Well, OK, then be realistic about what you're saying here.
I mean, I think basically, as long as the Lib Dems are willing to actually be socialists and be in a party with socialists, at least, then they can be as socially democratic as they want to be. Yeah. But there has
I think it's that second point, right? Like, you have to be comfortable being in a party together.
Yeah.
Right. They're probably not going to be socialists, but they can join you in working towards, you know, social democracy.
They can join us in a party whose membership card says this is a socialist party.
Yeah. So
somewhere, hang on. What does it say? So sad, isn't it, that I've got my Labour Party membership card in my purse. The Labour Party is a democratic socialist party, is the first line of clause four of our constitution.
Yeah.
It believes that by the strength of our common endeavour, we achieve more than we achieve alone, so as to create for each of us the means to realise our true potential, and for all of us as a community in which power, wealth and opportunity are in the hands of the many, not the few, where the rights we enjoy reflect the duties we owe, and where we live together freely in a spirit of solidarity, tolerance and respect.
Emma, I think that's absolutely lovely and delightful, and that is what I hope for. However, our lifetime, only one person has ever been elected a Labour Prime Minister, and that person didn't do it by embracing socialism.
No, but he wrote that.
Yeah.
That is clause four.
Yeah, and I'm good with it. All I'm saying is, if you want to win, You gotta win in a coalition. You're not going to be able to win as purely the socialist faction. You know,
I've argued that for 5 years. You know, we saw last December how disastrous it was when we tried. Yeah. I absolutely get that, but you've got to balance pragmatism with idealism. You can't just have one or the other.
I totally agree. And that's why my gift is controversial. My gift is Marmite. But I would just encourage my friends and colleagues on the left to just have a hard think about how can they bring people into their coalition that they disagree with, either by winning them over and persuading them. That's ideal, but rare. Yeah. So if that's not the case, where are the places where you can make
my tweet thread from yesterday?
I'm passively aggressive. I'm passive aggressively quoting you back to you. Right. Emma, I have a gift for you. I am assuming here that I have magical powers and that I can wave my magic wand and grant you. I am Santa, right? I am in the North Pole. And the elves have been in their little woodsheds knocking up with their wooden hammers, and they have packaged up this beautiful gift to you. Here it is, a lovely shiny box. Open it, unwrap it. Inside of it is a job reporting on American politics for British audiences.
I love you. That would be my ideal, yes. Specifically, if I could do it from America.
A job based out of Manhattan.
Exactly.
Reporting on American politics for British audiences to a large circulation. Go. Enjoy.
Oh,
treasure it.
My gift to you, I know that you had great plans for your wedding anniversary this year, and they were unable to come through. So my gift to you, with my magic wand, is a huge, huge party next year for you and Anna and all of your family and friends, all able to come and see you, mm-hmm. and us all to get together and celebrate you.
Well, I would love that. Yeah, it's been, we need a party.
Yeah.
We all need a party.
We all need a party.
Fantastic. Emma, thank you for your gift. Before we go, shall we play the gut check game?
Let's do it.
Right. Excellent. So for those who are new to the podcast, in front of me, I have some bits of paper onto which I have written down some quotes, sayings, things pulled from articles from around the political sphere this week. And last week too, actually, because I've got a few hungover from last week. I'm going to read them out, and Em and I are just going to react to them. So I'll pull them at random out of my trusty Red Sox baseball cap. And here is the first one. This is from an infamous Wall Street Journal editorial by Joseph Epstein. He writes, Madam First Lady, Mrs. Biden, Jill, kiddo, a bit of advice on what may seem like a small, but I think not unimportant matter. Any chance you might drop the doctor before your name? Dr. Jill Biden sounds and feels fraudulent, not to say a touch comic.
Why does it feel fraudulent? I mean, what the fuck? I mean, you'd never say that to a bloke. Ever. Ever.
Kiddo.
I mean, absolutely fuck the fuck off and keep it off.
You can fuck the fuck off and keep fucking.
But yeah, no. I mean, there's nothing else to say to that, is there? What a patronising C word.
Git. Yeah, oh, just so obnoxious. The thing I love about this is, so this fucker, Joseph Epstein, like, you know, I try not to just...
That name!
I mean, right? I'm sorry to all the Epsteins in the world who are not assholes, but man, you are not well represented by the public figures who bear your surname. My favorite thing about this fucker, Joseph Epstein, is later on in the article, he goes on about how he doesn't insist upon being called a doctor. Do you know why? He doesn't have a PhD. Like, he's a teacher but doesn't have a PhD. She does. So, yeah. He's trying to suggest. And then you get into like this whole thing of etymology, right? I'm going to be really pouncy and academic now, but like, he is trying to argue that because she doesn't have a medical degree, she should not call herself a doctor. But he's got the whole meaning of the words backwards. The title doctor was bestowed on people with PhDs, with academic qualifications, long before we adapted it for use by medical doctors. It's like, it goes the other way. So if anything, it's MDs who shouldn't be using the word doctor. But like, no one says that because it's fine. Like, no one is confused.
No, absolutely not. And it's not like she's going around, sitting on a plane and someone says, is there a doctor on the plane? And she's like, yeah. Oh, but actually not that kind of.
Yeah.
Pretending to be something she isn't. She's proud of her academic achievements.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a thing recently where women on Twitter were putting their academic titles in their Twitter handles because there isn't enough women role models in higher academia. So actually, you know, having someone in the position of first lady with a doctorate is actually a really good role model.
Yeah, I mean, she's a good role model in a number of ways. I mean, first of all, she's going to continue working while Joe is president, which I think is great. Like, she's just like, you know what? I'm so proud of him, but I have my own job, my own career, my life. I love teaching. I'm not going to stop teaching just because my husband has a different job. Fair, right? Secondly, she's a great role model because she didn't get the PhD as like a lot of students do straight out of university. She went back to graduate school, etc. No, she was teaching and working, and she kept doing night school. You know, as a working mom, she was also doing night school. Got two master's degrees just by working through that because she's an educationalist. So she was doing two masters in education, and then she decided, well, since I've done all this work anyway, I might as well do a PhD. Like, she's so relatable to me. This is a woman who, you know, did not like have the privilege of being able to just drop everything in her life and spend a few years studying, which would be wonderful and like many of us would want to, but she just balanced it around her life, her career, her kids, and then when she did it, she was really proud of herself. Like, good for her.
Absolutely.
Ugh, the Epsteins. This is a quote from Adam Schiff, who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. He's reacting to the fact that Trump has just announced 20 pardons. We just talked about the pardon system, including for a number of people prosecuted by the Mueller investigation. He says, quote, "If you lie to cover up for the president, you get a pardon. If you are a corrupt politician who endorsed Trump, you get a pardon. If you murder civilians while at war, you get a pardon."
I mean, as I say, I like the pardon system, but I might adapt it slightly to put a few more rules around it, because it does seem completely lawless, the way that it's being used at the moment. And, you know, the fact that you could pardon pretty much anyone, and of course he's talking about pardoning himself and his family for any future crimes or whatever. I mean, you need to do... I like the pardon system. I like the idea of clemency, but I would definitely put some boundaries on it.
Yeah. It's hard to define what those boundaries should be a little bit. So I think, you know, yes to all of that. I mean, it's a question of what's the pardon system for. I would definitely make clear within the pardon system that the president does not have the authority to pardon himself or his family members. Like, it's unclear that he has the right to pardon himself anyway, but let's just make absolutely clear he can't. And certainly his family members, I think, you know, should not be in his gift, etc. The rest of it, it's like, well, what's the point of the pardon system? Like, we have to define it, because if, you know, for example, here he's pardoning people that he believes wrongly were the subject of an unjust prosecution. I don't agree with that. Most people don't agree with that. There's nothing kind of in the law that says there's anything unjust about the Mueller probe, but that's kind of how the law is meant to work. That's what the pardon powder is for. So it's tricky.
It is tricky. I think Trump was probably named in the Mueller investigation somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think maybe anything...
Individual one.
Anything where you are a player.
Yeah.
I think should not fall within the pardon remit. I think that could be reasonably well stipulated.
Mm. Yeah, it's tricky though, because the president's always a player.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're not a player. You know, when Barack Obama pardoned 2,000 drug users, I mean, now he wasn't, you know, that fairly well. I know he's got a bit of a history, but...
I think that's a really interesting point, because one thing that I think has just been like under discussed in Trump's use of the pardon power, a lot of people have talked about how he's misused it, but there hasn't been any kind of serious conversation about the way he's refused to use it. Because there has been for decades an office of the pardon, right? Like, there's a pardon attorney's office, and they're normally, there's a process whereby people request clemency. They through their lawyers, they'll ask for a pardon, And then this office will process those and they'll come up with a list of things that they think are valid and propose those to the president, and the president makes a decision. Trump has just refused to engage with that process. He's not doing any of that. So like normal people who would might have actually been a miscarriage of justice, who just like want mercy, feel like there are circumstances like the 2000 drug dealers that you talked about for Obama, they don't have access to this system right now. So there's this inequity of like Trump is only using it to pardon his friends and family. He's not also using it for the public. And I think that's as much of an abuse of power as anything else. So I'm really sad about that. And again, I hope that's something that Biden has it in his power to fix immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, God, there's going to be such a backlog, isn't there?
Oh, God, yeah. Fortunately.
In the pardons in everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Backlog and everything. I mean, they're going to be busy, suffice to say. Speaking of which, so because they're going to be so busy, they're going to need some good appointees. This is my transition to a quote here from a Washington Post article about Miguel Cardona, who's the the current commissioner for public schools in Connecticut and Joe Biden's Secretary of Education nominee. I was very struck by this sentence, couple of sentences out of a Post article about him. Cardona's experience in public education, he was a teacher, fourth grade teacher, then became a principal at the age of 28, like really long career in public education for background. Cardona's experience in public education offers a sharp contrast to President Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, who attended private schools and spent much of her energy advocating for alternatives to public education. And though Cardona has lived in poverty, DeVos is a billionaire who has been wealthy all her life.
Yeah. I mean, Betsy DeVos was a dreadful education. But the public school system in America is so broken. I don't know if there's enough that can be done in 4 years to fix it, but it's got to be a good start.
Yeah. So the education is a difficult one. So first of all, I have to say this like every once in a while you have this moment of like, oh, everything is so bad, like these people are so bad, and just Betsy DeVos is one of the ones where like every time I read anything about her I'm like, oh, she's just bad, like because she's in charge of a system she doesn't believe in, like at all or care about, like
and that's a theme of the Trump administration, isn't it? They put someone in the head of EPA who doesn't believe in climate change,
But it's education. I'm not that I'm like arguing between education and climate, but neither of them should be partisan, right? Like, but education really shouldn't be. Like, everybody wants their kids to be well educated, but the only reason to attack public education is if you only want rich people to be educated. It's just so wrong. Anyway, what was my point? I'm so angry about this. But Miguel Cardona is somebody who has been through a lot of struggle, who's dedicated a career in public education. So it just, it's like, good, okay, good, do that. But wow, what a stark contrast.
The experts are back in the room.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I might as well do this one. This is from the bio of Deb Haaland, the Native American woman who's just become the first Native American to be nominated for Interior Secretary. Born in Arizona to a Native American mother who served in the Navy and a Norwegian-American father who was an active-duty Marine, Haaland bounced between 13 public schools as the family moved between military bases. After graduating high school, she worked at a bakery and started her own salsa company. I love that. She went to college and law school with the help of student loans and food stamps and occasionally experienced homelessness as a single mother. Now, after serving a single term in Congress, she will oversee a department that manages roughly one-fifth of the land in the United States.
Brilliant. Again, an inspiring backstory, but also doesn't that department actually oversee a lot of the Native American territory?
It does indeed.
And really important to have that voice in the room, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have a long overdue reckoning with what we have done to the Native American population. And I remember when Deb Haaland was elected, it was a very big thing to have a Native American in Congress, even. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just wildly underrepresented as a population and continuously harmed by policies, especially by the policies of the Bureau of Interior. Historically, that's the bureau which has been responsible for a lot of the migrations, for denying them kind of, you know, land settlements, for you know, things like water rights and land rights, etc. So, yeah, it's wonderful to have. I think it means a lot to the tribes in particular to have somebody in that specific role from their community. So that's great.
Brilliant.
Okay, here's one. I think we can end on this one because it cracked me up. This is a quote from someone called Reginald Stambau. He's a lawyer representing the DeMoss family. The DeMosses are a family that has a property next to Mar-a-Lago in Florida. And he says, per the use agreement of 1993, Mar-a-Lago is a social club and no one may reside on the property. To avoid an embarrassing situation for everyone and to give the president time to make other living arrangements in the area, we trust you will work with his team to remind them of the use agreement and parameters. Palm Beach has many lovely estates for sale and surely he can find one which meets his needs.
Wow. I mean, kudos for just trying it.
I love it,
but I want Trump to go home. So
yeah, but where's home? Like, Manhattan's his home, right?
Well, I don't think he's very welcome there.
He's not, but that's the thing, he's obviously not welcome in Palm Beach either.
Yeah. I think he's probably more Florida than he is Manhattan. Yeah. He boats from Florida, doesn't he?
Yeah,
by post, despite, you know, yeah, him constantly going on about it being corrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, Trump as a homeless man is quite a funny meme, but on the other hand, just get him out of the White House. That's what I really care about.
Yeah, I mean, he'll never be homeless. I mean, he owns a number of properties, but I just thought it was...
Or does he?
Well,
yeah, he's in debt up to his arsehole.
Yeah. I mean, he may not for very long. That's a good point. I mean, Deutsche Bank is going to call in their loans pretty soon. That's another thing that happened this week. It was like a little kind of side note, but the person at Deutsche Bank who's been managing Trump's loans has resigned and stepped down. And it's, you know, a lot of people have been saying it will now be very difficult for him to get those loans refinanced. So, yeah, it's feeling like the walls are closing in. But I just love the fact that his neighbors are like, nah, go live elsewhere. But also, like, it's great that it, like, things like residential clauses in estates, like, should come to bite him. That's so Trump, right? Because, yeah, like, that's exactly the kind of thing that he's always, you know, played fast and loose with himself. Yeah. And it's like, well, no, yeah, enforce that. Go.
Yeah, absolutely. Live by the rules, dude.
Yeah, for once. For once in your life. So, Emma, thank you for spending this time with us. Happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year. I wish you a happy, healthy Christmas. And here's to a...
a very unhealthy one. I'm going to eat like a horse for once.
Healthy, unhealthy in the right way.
Same to you and all your family as well.
Thank you very much. Happy holidays. And that's it. As always, you can reach me on Twitter at KarinJR, KarinJR on Twitter. I hope you and your family and your loved ones are having a healthy, happy, safe Christmas season wherever you are. And stay clear of that virus, folks, okay? I will speak to you in the new year.